You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people, the places, oh yeah, and the poltergeists of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Halloween is just a couple of weeks away, and it's time to get spooky. So we headed to the Mystic Museum in Burbank. That creepy singing you hear is inside the museum's early 2000s horror movie exhibit, celebrating films such as Trick or Treat and Saw. The Mystic Museum is part of what's known as Horror Row in Burbank. It is where several horror and Halloween-themed shops operate all year round. Yeah, it's October now, but why would you seek out spine-tingling thrills in, say, April? KCRW's Megan Jamerson has some answers.
Even before the Mystic Museum opens at 11 a.m. on a Saturday, there's a crowd of at least a dozen people waiting. Elizabeth Williams is one of them. She has burgundy red hair and the Bride of Frankenstein tattooed on her forearm.
I mean, I grew up reading Stephen King and Goosebumps. And Are You Afraid of the Dark was on Nickelodeon. Yeah. And so we kind of grew up, I think, in an era where it was fun to be scared.
Williams is the kind of fan that this area is made for. She lives in Phoenix and is in town for the horror convention Son of Monster Palooza. She used to live in Burbank and always comes back to Horror Row anytime she visits Southern California.
And you find a lot of that old classic horror in places like this. You know, it's just fun. It makes you feel like a kid again, I guess.
At Horror Row, you can buy costumes, decorations, and horror-themed cookbooks. Some of these places have been around for decades.
Believe it or not, for a lot of people, it is a lifestyle. It is what they do, it's what they love, and it's what they enjoy.
That's Jaleel Gardner, the store manager at the Mystic Museum. His favorite horror movie is the campy 1983 slasher Sleepaway Camp, which he watches at least six times a year.
There's fanatics in everything, like sports, whatever you're into, music, but don't underestimate the horror movie fanatics, because they do exist. Some people dress up in outfits all year round.
They come here for books on witchcraft, 80s slasher film memorabilia, and Victorian oddities. Think taxidermy and real human skeletons.
You know, people donate their bodies to science, and that's how we kind of get these stuff in the store.
The two real human skeletons for sale at the store used to be the property of teaching hospitals. But when those closed, the store was able to get them. The museum's second location is an exhibit space a couple of blocks east. It changes every 3 months. And right now, they have props from the 1981 film Evil Dead. There's also dozens of vintage Ouija boards and a Zoltar fortune-telling machine.
Zoltar speaks.
Okay, but why do we really like horror literature, movies, and TV shows? Well, psychologists know that some people feel happier after a scare. Others find horror helps them cope with real-life anxieties. And get this, researchers at a lab in Denmark that studies the fun of fear, yes, this is a thing, published a paper in 2021 that showed horror fans and morbidly curious individuals were better able to cope with the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic. Plus, here's another reason horror deserves our attention.
Horror is a great way to express what's going on in society.
Del Howison isn't a sociologist, but he holds a lot of cred in the horror industry. He and his wife, Sue Howison, opened Burbank's first horror shop, a bookstore called Dark Delicacies. And they can count big names like Academy Award-winning filmmaker Guillermo del Toro amongst their fans.
Here is all your receipts.
Del Howison is making a sale, as he has for almost 30 years. He has long white hair and is wearing a black T-shirt with a goat skull and pentagram design. He points to monster movies from the late 50s to show what he means about horror and social anxiety. Anyway, that's the first time he got into the genre. Here he was at the movies as a kid without his parents, watching the 1958 supernatural horror film The Case of the Faceless Man.
Thank you.
You go under the chair and the jujubes stick to you and stuff, so hiding behind your hands but peeking through them. It was fun.
Those monster films were using the fear of the other. American culture at the time was all about conformity. And if you didn't fit the norm, the message was clear, says Howison.
You don't really fit in with us, so there's something wrong with you. And then you don't know that you're being indoctrinated into that because it's just everyday life.
Fast forward to his adulthood, and other things about society revealed themselves, like queer themes around the LGBTQ experience, or...
Like when the AIDS crisis came up, we saw a rise in vampire stories and vampire stories coming off of those vampire stories. And when 9/11 happened and we watched the people in business suits walking out of the ashes covered just gray in New York, the rise of the zombie story, because they looked in very much like some of the zombies you see. And now we just had the plague, and you're seeing a lot of plague stories.
When he started the store, he wasn't sure if enough people would be into it. He still remembers the first author signing where they drew a crowd, and he thought to himself,
oh my gosh, there really are other idiots that like this stuff as much as I do. After that, it's, we've been around long enough that I think they kind of have a feel that this is their clubhouse.
A clubhouse to enjoy the fun of fear. For KCRW, I'm Macon Jamerson.
Well, don't worry. Don't worry. Just ahead, it helped redefine how funny movies were made. The three directors behind the slapstick hit Airplane wrote a book about their decades ago experience, and surely you'll want to stick around after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now from Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Into the friendly and funny skies we go.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
We're en route to the year 1980, when three guys from Wisconsin, early in their film careers, made a hilarious parody movie called Airplane. And the opening scenes are of a not-so-different LAX.
Zone is for immediate loading and unloading of passengers only. There's no stopping in the white zone.
No, the white zone is for loading and unloading, and there is no stopping in the red zone.
The red zone has always been for loading and unloading.
Don't tell me which zone is for stopping and which zone is for loading.
Listen, Betty, don't start up with your white zone again.
43 years later, those three guys, all directors of Airplane, got together and wrote about their adventure. The book is called Surely You Can't Be Serious, and all three are here right now talking about it. David Zucker, welcome to you.
I'm David Zucker, yes.
We also have Jim Abrahams. Hi, Jim.
Howdy. Good to be here.
Good to have you. And Jerry Zucker is also with us. Hi there, Jerry.
Hello. Actually, I'm David.
You're not David. You're Jerry.
Okay.
Can I just say that the white zone, red zone people needed a movie of their own? By the way,
that would have been,
yes,
would have been better than Airplane 2.
Yeah. Yeah, or a TV series would have been right. Great. Yeah.
And, you know, LAX was still the ridiculous mess that it is even today, right? Maybe a little more manageable then, but
there was only one level.
There was only one level, right?
It was sleepy country airport compared to what it is now.
Y'all made this movie as an homage, right, to the disaster movies of the 70s, including this one.
This is Airport 77.
Drown in here.
Nobody is going to drown. The plane is pressurized.
Have you radioed for help? What'll we do?
Calm down.
Airport 77. Bigger, more exciting than Airport 75.
I never heard that.
It gets me every time.
Yeah.
Bigger, even better than Airport 75. But, I mean, you had the Poseidon Adventure. You had Airport 75, which didn't come even close to Airport 77, if you believe the Towering Inferno, right? Is that what Airplane was to y'all? It was an homage to those kind of disaster movies?
No, actually, we got a hold of the 1957 flying movie called Zero Hour, written by Arthur Haley. And it's essentially the same plot, close enough that we had to buy it and buy the rights to it. And we really, in our minds, we were doing more of a parody on, you know, the 50s hard-hitting drama. Originally, we even wanted to do it in black and white on a propeller plane. But fortunately, Michael Eisner talked us out of that.
Michael Eisner. Disney's Michael Eisner.
Yes, but then he was the president of Paramount, and after every studio had turned down the Airplane script, Eisner heard about it and had us into his office, and we did it there.
And the rest is history, as they say.
And it's kind of interesting, too, because we started writing Airplane in 1974, which was just the beginning of that decade of awful disaster movies. And so we were sort of the benefactors, being in the right place at the right time, with the right material.
And Eisner had been actually an executive at ABC, and he actually produced a lot of those Airplane and Trouble movies.
Really?
So he was already a fan of that. So naturally, I think he connected, hey, do a comedy on an airplane, and that might work.
So this movie was released more than 40 years ago. Why write a book about it now? In 2023.
Well, it didn't take that long. We actually started writing it 8 years ago. So it just took us, we're kind of
right,
slow.
So
yeah, we've been writing this forever. Yeah.
We started thinking about it 8 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
And I think we were so blown away all those years later that the movie has maintained and stayed popular and that the jokes all still work. And so I think primarily, at least for me, and I think both of the other guys too, we wanted to have a record of what went on back then, just in case someday our kids or our grandkids or something wanted to know what happened.
And I think in about 2016, we happened to be reading the Onion, and there was a whole oral history of Airplane done by a writer named Will Harris. And we thought, well, this is interesting. I mean, we're always interested in ourselves.
Did Will Harris get it right?
He did. And okay. So we hired him to do the interviews for this book.
So this book follows the journey to making this movie. How did y'all get together in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, a lot of the guys in our high school class, we thought we were funnier than we were, but they were just able to get jobs. And we just started doing these bits. We got a hold of some videotape equipment and messing around. And that kind of morphed into a theater, which we called Kentucky Fried Theater. And we moved the show to L.A. in 72. And then we did that for 5 years before we did Kentucky Fried Movie, which is based on that.
Where'd you do the show in L.A.?
On Pico Boulevard, across the street from Rancho Park.
From Rancho Park. Okay, so near the Fox lot.
Yeah.
Right down the street from 20th Century Fox.
Yeah. And what, in a theater? Or where
it was an old warehouse that we hammered and nailed and converted into a 140-seat theater.
No way.
It was supposed to be 130 seats, but I think we put chairs in the aisle. So.
Well, that was nice.
And, yeah.
There are pictures in the book of when we got to... when we found the theater, and of us doing construction, converting the old warehouse or drug hab facility into a theater.
Something that y'all emphasized when casting the movie was the actors had to play the comedy straight-faced, right?
Well, not even only straight-faced. We told them you have to do the lines as though you didn't even know you were in a comedy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it wasn't an easy concept to understand, especially because actors, they were cast in a comedy, so they thought they had to be funny. Even Leslie, we had to send him home with a videotape of Zero Hour, and we said, do it like the doctor did in this 1957 movie. And so he came back the next day, and he was set for life.
Dr. Rumek, yeah.
He was perfect, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you had Lloyd Bridges, you had Robert Stack, you had Peter Graves, all very serious actors.
Yeah.
Right.
But that was always the intention from the very beginning when we started writing it. As a matter of fact, we wrote it thinking about Robert Stack, just because there was something about, we had spent so much time watching The Untouchables, and just there was something about him that was so sort of macho, cool, tough.
And completely humorless. But Robert Stack, the person, was, you know, very jovial and telling funny stories all the time.
Well,
on the
came
set.
Through in the movie too, right? He was straight-laced in the movie, but it was funny.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. And I think that that's part of the endearing legacy of Airplane, is that all those guys, Stack, Bridges, Graves, Nielsen, had spent their whole careers playing these straight roles. And suddenly they were having fun at their own expense. And, you know, if you can laugh at yourself, that's pretty endearing.
That's pretty endearing. Could and some of the comedy, you know, I mean, a lot of folks would say is a little insensitive for 2023 standards. Could Airplane be made today?
Well, yeah, just without the jokes.
Yeah, no, I think it could. I think
one of the most fun things ever was to sit in an audience when the movie came out and listen to people laugh. Well, we can't do that very much anymore. Occasionally there'll be a screening, but there is something on YouTube where they show people today watching Airplane for the first time, and most of the people who they show watching it weren't even alive when we made the movie, but all the jokes, including Peter Graves in the cockpit and Kareem and the Malumbos and all that, they hold up as well today as they did 43 years ago.
Yeah, actual humans seeing the movie always laugh. You know, we've showed it a lot of times. It's just, if we pitch those jokes today in a studio executive boardroom, they'd probably be frightened because that job description is frightened people.
But would there be backlash?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, if it was done in that same tone,
yeah,
where we're taking swipes at everything and everyone kind of affectionately, I think it works as well today as it did back then.
It's amazing. I know we thought it was going to be a big hit when we made it and it was released, but we never would have guessed that it would have hung around so long.
The book is called Surely You Can't Be Serious. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for making us laugh all these years. We appreciate it. David Zucker, Jim Abrahams, and Jerry Zucker, thanks for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
That's fun.
More now from Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. As the war in Ukraine drags on and infrastructure crumbles there, one LA nonprofit has found a creative way to help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, have it back. Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Miyamoto Relief is a local design and engineering firm that focuses on disaster zone reconstruction. It's supported rebuilding and resiliency efforts all over the world, a lot of it following natural disasters such as earthquakes. Think Morocco and Turkey. Well, now they're partnering with folks on the ground in Kyiv to help rebuild a school there hit by bombs. To raise money for the project, Miyamoto is hosting dual events here in Los Angeles and in Kyiv called the Night of a Thousand Drawings, complete with Ukrainian music, art, and food. And joining us to discuss that event is Sabine Kast, who's executive director of Miyamoto Relief. Sabine, welcome.
Thank you so much, Steve. Hi.
The Night of a Thousand Drawings. Where does the concept come from? How does it work?
It's an extraordinary event that brings together a diverse community of artists, architects, entrepreneurs, developers, musicians, you know, Los Angelinos like you and I, for a really unique charitable art sale. And so how it works is over the past months, we've collected more than 1,000 drawings from the community, from school children in LA. Ukrainian children also drew and sent us their, you know, mailed in their images from people like you and me again, from renowned Los Angeles artists. And the 1,000 drawings will be exhibited this Saturday at the Night of 1,000 Drawings at the Cooper Design Space to form sort of a massive community art installation. Attendees of the event receive an envelope upon arrival and can then select and their favorite piece of art and take it home.
The art comes, as you mentioned, from the kids at school number 165, right, in Kyiv. But also from schools here in LA as well.
Absolutely. We've had architects, artists in LA, musicians. We've had drawing parties where, you know, non-artists try to draw for a difference. So we've collected this from really all corners of Los Angeles.
What about the things happening on the ground in Ukraine? You're trying to rebuild this school that was hit by Russian bombs, right? What is the effort going on there with your organization?
At the school that we're working to support through the Night of 1,000 Drawings, at School 165, about 400 kids go to school there every single day. And sadly, schools become a target in war. And the school has sustained pretty heavy damages. And so the funds will help us repair the school. But even more so, you know, the war is still raging on. And on a very regular basis, like almost weekly, there are missile strikes and bombs flying, and the kids find safe shelter in the school's bomb shelter.
It's just awful. But I that's, I guess, leads me to this other awful question that I have to ask, which is, you know, get all this money to rebuild this school, and you've done this in different areas as well. What's the guarantee that, you know, it doesn't happen again, that another bomb doesn't take out the school?
Absolutely. So, you know, we do call them emergency repairs. There is no guarantee. However, emergency repair work just improves the conditions of these schools so that at least for the time being, because kids are still having to go to school, that the conditions at the school are bearable.
I know this is a labor of love for you and for this organization. For folks who are listening, what can be done? What can you do to get involved, more involved, besides just the Night of 1,000 Drawings?
You know, as Amanda Gorman says, may we not grieve but give, may we not ache but act. And I think that the Night of 1,000 Drawings, I know beyond that, but the Night of 1,000 Drawings is a really incredible opportunity, you know, to have fun, to come together as a community, to, you know, gain an incredible piece of art, and thereby contribute. And so we do look at community-based ways of getting together and through creativity, you know, generating resources and awareness around these causes.
Sabine Cast, Executive Director of Miyamoto Relief. The Night of 1,000 Drawings event is taking place again Saturday night at the Cooper Design Space in downtown LA. Sabine, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Steve.
And by the way, one of the artists playing is a musician named Nina Anto, and we're gonna play out this segment with Nina Anto and give it a listen. And again, go to our website for more details, kcrw.com/GLA. That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow at this time, 1 and 6 o'clock, The Business with Kim Masters. Documentary filmmaker Ken Burns talks about his latest project, The American Buffalo, the close relationship between indigenous people and North America's largest mammal, and how white settlers almost drove the species to extinction. That's tomorrow on The Business. Next week on GLA, your questions answered about recycling and more about KCRW's new podcast called The Anti-Dread Climate Podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find Greater LA wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KCRW Greater LA. Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Kelsey Gante, Eddie Sun, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Sue Margulies, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Michael Joson, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordall all helped run this evening's program. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time. Thanks for that ear. Bye-bye.